This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's not Matt McNeil. It's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt on a Monday afternoon. I'm back in the hosting chair for just one day today, as Matt is off today, but he will be back tomorrow. Lots of news, of course, to cover today. We have the opening day of the Derek Chauvin trial. We also have some other news to get to, but I do want to start things off by going to our legal expert, Jack Rice. He is an attorney, former CIA analyst, has worn many hats over the years, including hosting some shows on AM 950, as he's going to walk us through what he saw today and the opening day of the Chauvin trial and how both the prosecution and the defense have done so far. Jack Rice, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Brett, I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So I want to start off with the opening statements and the prosecution, because to me, they laid out a very thorough case walking through the entire timeline of what happened to George Floyd. And I think they really went out of their way to try to knock down one of the defense's arguments that we're probably going to hear. And that's the fact that, well, the drugs in George Floyd's system contributed to his death. But I thought the prosecution did a good job laying out the fact that, well, if someone were really dying from an opioid overdose, it typically wouldn't look like what we saw from George Floyd. So talk a little bit about what you saw from the opening statement by the prosecution.
Let's start with the prosecution. The state's decision to use the prosecutor that they did use, I think, was a really, really smart choice. Jerry Blackwell is a very, very good lawyer. And we have to understand who Jerry Blackwell is. Jerry Blackwell is not with the Attorney General's office. In fact, he's not even a prosecutor. In fact, what he is a civil lawyer, but an extraordinarily good civil lawyer. And so Keith Ellison, or whoever it was that made the decision to bring in Jerry Blackwell, although I know that he was advising the Attorney General's office previously, to bring him in on the opening, I think was really smart. He's low-key. He's thoughtful. He's a big picture, so he thinks about things from a historical standpoint, first of all, and so he can think about it in that sense, and then he can deliver that issue. And if we also add this additional piece, because I think it is important, he is a person of color. As a black man, to stand there and talk about this case, I think adds an element that I think is necessary, because one of the things the defense tried to do is they tried to make the argument that this isn't political, this isn't about social change. And the response is, that's simply not the case. You can't deny the reality of the politics on the ground, especially not just of what happened, but we can go back 400 years and talk about the police and black men in this country and what has happened. So I think it was critical in that sense. But if we look at what it was that Jerry Blackwell delivered, he was slow, he was methodical, he worked his way through this trial, worked his way through this evidence, including demonstratives. What I mean by that is he brought up things from the autopsy report and used them in his opening. But what he did first and foremost is he showed that 8-minute and 46-second trial videotape. And I think that was critical, because it is the most important, the most powerful, the most legally significant, but I think the most viscerally gut-wrenching of all of the evidence that the prosecution has. And so when he laid that out, what it did was it laid out not just the groundwork for where they were going, but really the underlying fear and the visceral nature of this case to drive this jury to make the decision that he wanted them to make.
So now let's turn things around and look at the defense's opening statements. They tried to emphasize the fact that, well, this case is more than what you're just going to see on that video of just over 8 minutes. They also made some interesting arguments talking about how the crowd could have contributed to Chauvin's behavior. They, of course, talked about how there were drugs in George Floyd's system. Talk a little bit about what you saw from the defense's opening statements.
if we think about what the defense is trying to argue here, I don't want to say it's simple, but it is to some degree. In the end, what Jerry Blackwell said was, it was Derek Chauvin who killed George Floyd. It is that simple. What we know is that from a defense perspective, their argument was different and even slightly more nuanced. What they were trying to argue, what they were trying to explain was, it was a combination of things, including George Floyd's behavior on this date. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was aggressive and fighting back with the police and not listening and pushing back against them, that was a piece of it. The fact that he had serious heart conditions, which he was aware of, and those actually came out, and specifically the fact of the fentanyl and the methamphetamine in his system, all of those things in combination created an environment that resulted in George Floyd's death. In fact, this was really a setup for what's coming down the road when there's going to be multiple medical exams that will come in, essentially autopsy reports that will talk about what killed George Floyd. But in a very simple fashion, what the defense was arguing was George Floyd killed George Floyd. Derek Chauvin did not.
And that's where I want to question you on this right here, because I have some trouble understanding exactly what the statute is right now in Minnesota in terms of what would happen if George Floyd did have drugs in his system. The way I thought I understood the statute was that even if Floyd did had drugs in his system, if Chauvin kneeling on his neck even contributed to his death, wouldn't that still be enough for him to be found guilty even if he did have drugs in his system? If that kneeling on his neck contributed to his death, wouldn't that be enough for him to be guilty?
An excellent point you make, my friend, because that's in fact what Jerry Blackwell was talking about too. The difference is really this, is that what the defense is trying to argue here, is trying to motivate and convince a jury of, is that if we can show sort of all of the things that George Floyd did that contributed to this, that made this what this was, they're trying to convince them to say, but for George Floyd's behavior, this never would have happened in the first place, and that in itself should be enough. That's their argument. It's an uphill climb because of that piece. And in fact, it's going to be easier to prosecute and convict on the third-degree murder charge and on the manslaughter charge than it will be on that second-degree unintentional murder charge because of some of the standards. It's that causation piece that makes it harder for the prosecution at that level. But those other two charges don't have the standard that that first charge has.
Well, another argument we saw made by the defense is that, well, Derek Chauvin was behaving the way that he was trained by the Minneapolis police. Are there any legal protections that could possibly absolve Chauvin of responsibility for Floyd's death?
Well, I would rather put it like this, and this is one of the problems that the city has, the city council has, and the prosecution does have in this case. Because what we know is this. This technique was problematic. We know that there are a lot of places in Minnesota and across the country that have outlawed this technique. We know that too. We also know that as soon as this case came about, the Minneapolis City Council outlawed this technique. The Minneapolis Police Department outlawed this technique. And the state of Minnesota outlawed this technique. And so the problem that the state has, and I watched Jerry Blackwell try to thread this needle, is that he's going to talk about how fundamentally dangerous this is. What the defense is going to do is they're going to say, we agree. We completely agree with you. In fact, it's outrageous. But the problem is if you're a Minneapolis police officer and your job is to apply the techniques that the Minneapolis Police Department suggests and allow you to apply, it's a judgment call that you can make under sometimes very volatile circumstances. You don't get to have it both ways by saying, well, we hate this thing, but we allow this thing, and we hate that you use this thing, but we allow this thing. So it's going to be one of those issues where Derek Chauvin can actually potentially use the policy of the Minneapolis Police Department as a shield for himself to say, if you didn't want us to use this technique, then why didn't you outlaw it in the first place?
And I suppose expanding on that, that's going to make the testimony we're going to have later on in the trial from Chief Arredondo and then also Lieutenant Johnny Mercel, who is with the Minneapolis Police Department and is someone who is in charge of their use of force training coordinator. I suppose that's going to make their testimonies very significant later on in the trial.
Oh, huge. And it's great that you're making that point, because if we think about Arredondo and we think about the senior supervisors within the Minneapolis Police Department, my response, if I'm defending Derek Silva, again, as you know, I'm a former prosecutor. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in this town for a very long time. I've tried a lot of cases in the city. Is that if we think about this, I go at those guys with both fists. Because my response is, it's all well and good that you get to sit up here now with your bright, shiny badges and point at this guy and say what he did wrong and how he was wrong, when this entire time, throughout your entire careers, when you had the opportunity to overturn this technique, to not use this technique against anybody, black, white, or otherwise, you chose to turn your head. Now, all of a sudden, when it's convenient for you, well, how hypocritical is that? And I think you have the ability to sort of ride your high horse on the defense side in very few places in this trial when you have the ability to do that. The problem is that what this has the potential of doing, this has a potential of pushing the blame at the city and at the Minneapolis Police Department. And in fact, if we think about the agreement that was made between the city council, this $27 million agreement that was made with the Floyd family, my response, if I'm defending them on a case like this, is to say there's a reason you settled in this case. And the reason you settled wasn't because of what Derek Chauvin did. Well, it's because the idiocy of the Minneapolis Police Department. And that provides shelter. It provides, again, that shield. So that's what makes this a bit complicated.
So really, in essence, is the best defense strategy of Chauvin just to throw the city of Minneapolis and the police department under the bus, saying this was the problem of how I was trained? And as you were talking about mixed messaging on how you can use this force, is that almost their best strategy, you would think?
Absolutely. I would be all about that. What you do is you blame the city. If this was so horrible, if this was so bad and this was so dangerous, then tell me, why would you not just say, well, you know, we don't want you to use it, but if you have to use it, no. It was available. We were trained on it. We were supposed to use this. And what you get to do is you get to bring in experts of your own, but you get to spend a long time talking about police policy in general. And in Minneapolis, to say, not about this technique, but about any technique, and say, you apply techniques because they allow for certain types of behavior by your police officers. You have vetted these techniques? Yes. You have allowed these techniques? Yes. And you allow these techniques because it's not just about the safety of the officers, right? Yes. But also for the safety of the people on the streets? Yes. And you work your way through them to really buttress the importance of all of the techniques generally that the city has okayed, has put their stamp of approval on. Now, once you get that, you say, this was one of those techniques. This was a technique that you were aware of. This was a technique that you knew was being applied. This was a technique that you knew that was being applied in your city under your watch, and you still allow this technique, just like all those other techniques that you say are designed to protect the people and designed to protect police officers. That's something that they're going to have a hard time wiggling out of if the defense team does this right. I'm not sure if they're going to do it right, but if they do, they should be able to really come across and strike a couple of blows of their own, so to speak.
We're speaking with Jack Rice. He is an attorney and legal expert, as he, of course, has been following the Derek Chauvin trial, as that's what we're talking about right now. So obviously, the video recordings of what we saw happen to George Floyd are certainly going to be played a lot and referenced a lot during the trial. Now, to me, the video looks pretty cut and dry that Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. But could there be anything in those video recordings that the defense could use to try to bolster their case?
Yeah, there's no question. And in fact, that's one of the things that the defense was trying to do during the openings, right? The idea of making the argument that when you had people becoming increasingly angry, getting increasingly close the potential of the threat that that may cause to divert attention to them and away from the scene, the ability to miss what you might have otherwise been able to see, to say that, understand that the chaos that was in place, it was so chaotic that to assume that this was being done in isolation, in sort of a vacuum-packed room that you could clearly see everything that was going on, that wasn't the case. There were people moving in and out and screaming and cursing and everything else at these officers, that this was a part of what was going on. That's one piece. A big part of this is going to be about George Floyd not being cooperative about getting out of the car, not being cooperative about being put in the car, using his body, using his size, being in excess of 6 foot, 223 pounds, Derek Chauvin, 5 foot 4, 5 foot 9, 145 pounds. They were specific about putting that in. The purpose is to try to lay out that when George Floyd started pushing back, and he not only ignored the lawful orders of a police officer, he used his body against the officers themselves. Those are actually gross misdemeanor charges of obstruction with force. If you get somebody who obstructs with force, how much more force do you need to use? And if they continue to push back, how much more force can you use? This is that use of force continuum that they were talking about. All of these are issues that the defense will try to use. I'm not sure if they'll be successful or not, but they will try to use to make the point that this isn't as simple as you think. This 8 minute and 46 second video isn't the whole story. And in fact, if you start picking it apart rather than looking at it big picture, you're going to find there's a whole series of things in this report that may be very troubling for George Floyd, if you want to put it that way, and not just for Derek Chauvin.
Now, going back to something you were talking about just a few minutes ago, how the defense might try to make the argument that the gathering crowd could have possibly impacted the behavior of Derek Chauvin and his use of force in that situation. If I'm a juror sitting there, this is just me sitting here as a non-legal expert, my reaction would be, you got to be kidding me. How can you possibly say that the crowd was posing a threat? How might the defense make that argument? And then expanding on that, how might the prosecution try to counter that, saying, well, no, the crowd really wasn't a threat whatsoever?
That's great. You're right. But what I'm saying was, that's what the defense did during their openings. You saw it too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, that's the problem. Is it, you're making this argument that these people are saying he can't breathe. You can see he can't breathe. He's dying right there. I mean, this is, they're saying it over and over and over again. And the question is if you're questioning the authority of a police officer, is that obstructing with an officer? If you're telling an officer that they're killing somebody on the street, are you threatening an officer? Explain that to me. And I think that's really where the prosecution team will come back and say, that's not how this works. Is there anybody who used force against any of these officers on the street? And the answer is no. Is there somebody who tried to push anybody off of anybody? Anybody who actually threatened to hurt an officer, to punch an officer, to do anything physically to an officer? And I didn't see it in the videotape. So your problem is that argument really doesn't hold water. I think the best they're going to get was, you don't know in a volatile situation what's coming at you. And if someone is screaming at you, you have to divert your attention, at least to some degree, to watch what they're doing, to watch their hands, to watch their demeanor, to watch for weapons. So you're not just standing there looking straight down. You're looking around, because it's also about being on the defense. And so that's, I think, where the defense in this case will try to make that argument.
And final topic I want to go through with you on, Jack, is the testimony we saw earlier today from the 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry, who I thought made some pretty powerful statements, saying that, well, she generally never calls the supervising officer when there's a situation that she might be questioning. She basically said that she was very concerned about what she was seeing on the video recordings or on the live video from the camera. And she was also saying that, well, I thought the video was almost frozen for a second. Those, to me, seem like some pretty powerful statements that she was making, saying that, well, this was the first time she ever had to call a supervising officer for that very type of situation.
Yeah, I thought she was incredibly credible. I really do. When you watched her, I thought her demeanor was dead on. I didn't think she was over the top. I didn't think she had some sort of axe to grind here. I think she was a professional trying to do her job as best that she could, and that she had real experience, and she just told you what she thought. And I think those are the kinds of witnesses that are powerful in the minds of jurors, because they like them. They believe them. And when they say something, you're like, yeah, I see what you're saying. So I think that that's the kind of witness, if they have more of those and they can line those up, this may be more problematic as time goes on.
Yeah, that's an interesting way you put that, because I had that feeling, too, as I was watching part of her testimony and listening to it, is that she seemed very matter-of-fact and straightforward and not like she had any sort of agenda to grind, which I think, as you said, that's exactly what you want the jurors to hear.
Yeah, I mean, all I know is that it's all about credibility. Mm-hmm. And if you get somebody who can stand up and look you in the face and say, look, this is what I saw. This is what I thought it meant. And it's clear that you're not trying to get to an outcome. You're just trying to be as honest as you can with what you had at the time. And you can get out something like that. I think people will respect it. They'll listen to it. And when you say something, it gives you a lot more credibility. And when you lose that credibility is when all of a sudden you've decided that, and frankly, I would argue this is true on either side. You get somebody who's decided that no matter what, Derek Chauvin is going down. The problem is you take the stand and that's your demeanor and that's where you're going versus let me tell you what I know and you decide what you do with this. There's power in that, because the fear is that if you have an outcome, whether it's Derek Chauvin is going down or whether Derek Chauvin should walk, you decide which. The problem is that the perception that people will have is colored by your motivation. And so the fear is that your arguments, your statements, your beliefs will be colored by your opinions rather than saying, let the chips fall where they may.
We've been speaking with Jack Rice, of course, a defense attorney, also former host here on AM 950. You can learn more about him at jackrice.org, as he's been kind enough to sit in with us and talk a little about what he saw in the Derek Chauvin trial from today. Jack, appreciate you running long with me today and talking through this case right now.
Happy to do it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks again, Jack. We'll take a break and come on back with more here on the Matt McNeil Show. Again, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil here on a Monday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Monday afternoon. Matt will be back in tomorrow with a live show, but you're with me today as I step into the hosting chair for just one day. Of course, you might remember me from the old FYI Politics with Brett Johnson show that used to air every weekday from 2 until 3 p.m. Stepped away from that role to do some other things here at the station and also outside the station, but always good to be back in the hosting chair every once in a while. So if you want to talk with me today, I'm at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Always good to bring on Jack Rice, because Patrick, I don't know if you're a trained attorney. I most certainly am not a trained attorney. So getting Jack's perspective on what's happening at the trial is really interesting, because as I was listening to the opening statements from the defense, I'm sitting there thinking, they're really arguing that somehow the crowd was the cause of Derek Chauvin's actions. But as Jack kind of explained, it's largely what the defense's job is to do, is to cloud what happened with the murder of, at least in my opinion, the murder of George Floyd from Derek Chauvin, saying that there were other contributing factors and largely along the lines of beyond a reasonable doubt. You remember that old concept. So we'll see what happens in this case, but I am so concerned that if we don't end up having Derek Chauvin convicted of one of these murder charges, I would just be very, very concerned about what could happen in Minneapolis, and it could make what happened last year look like nothing compared to what could happen in 2021 if he gets acquitted on these charges. Or here's another thing to think about. What if Derek Chauvin is convicted only of third-degree murder? That's the fallback option we've often heard talked about from different legal analysts that, well, murder too could be hard to prove, that second degree murder, but third degree murder is much easier to prove in the court of law. And the concern would be, well, let's say they do end up convicting Derek Chauvin of third degree murder. What if he only faces something like 8 to 10 years in prison? I don't know if that's going to necessarily give off the feeling that justice was served for George Floyd. So I don't envy anyone who's in that courtroom, especially one of those jurors. That is an incredibly difficult job right now. But I have a lot of concerns about what's going to happen if that verdict ends up going the way of Derek Chauvin and the defense. I'm just very afraid that we could end up with a nasty situation in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the entire metro area. So we'll see what happens in the coming days. Of course, Matt will be covering more of that trial later this week. Hopefully we'll have some other guests on that can talk more in depth about the trial. Now, Patrick, did you have a chance to listen to any of the opening statements today or any of the trial? Yeah, I was kind of with you. I caught a little bit of some of the opening statements, but for me, again, not being a trained lawyer, it's tough to listen to some of these things and try to decipher what exactly is being said. And that's why I appreciate someone like Jack Rice coming on the air to help us out with that. Or at least like what I was doing earlier today is reading a lot of these media reports from legal analysts, because unless you're a trained lawyer, sometimes what you're seeing and hearing on those live streams can be a little misleading as to what both the prosecution and the defense are trying to accomplish. By the way, I had a chance to speak with Kevin Featherly earlier today, and we were talking about how this is very unusual at the district court level to get a trial like this live streamed in the state of Minnesota. In fact, I think it's the first time this has ever happened. Now, generally, you can stream trials at the appellate and the Supreme Court level, but of course, at the district court level, a lot of judges have different thoughts about why it probably wouldn't be a great idea to stream or live stream some of the district court trials. Now, of course, if you're wondering, district court is, of course, the lowest level of the court system. It goes district court, appellate court, and then, of course, the Supreme Court is at the highest level. We'll be joined by Kevin Featherly, by the way, coming up during the 5 o'clock hour, as we're going to chat more about this state Supreme Court ruling that we saw last week that has to do with sexual assault and intoxication. Here's a little preview of it, though, if you missed it last week. I know Matt had a chance to talk about it a number of times last week, but basically what the state Supreme Court ruled was that a person who is sexually assaulted while intoxicated does not fit the designation for a more serious charge if he or she consumed the alcohol or drugs voluntarily. So in other words, if you voluntarily consumed alcohol or drugs, someone who does end up sexually assaulting you could potentially not be liable if you took the alcohol and drugs voluntarily. As you can imagine, that is a very problematic ruling from a lot of different aspects, including something that would very much concern me. If we don't have a statute in place that can correct this and end up saying that, well, it shouldn't matter if someone consumed drugs or alcohol voluntarily, it's still sexual assault. If we don't get an actual statute on the books, I would be very concerned that you could eventually run into a case where someone might not want to report a sexual assault because they might sit there and think, well, I guess I consumed the alcohol voluntarily, and therefore I'm probably not going to get a conviction in this case. So something's got to be done at the state legislature at that level. But coming up during the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to chat with Kevin Featherly of Minnesota Lawyer much more about that state Supreme Court case last week and why the court ruled the way they did, because there are a lot of people who are rightfully upset about this state Supreme Court ruling, saying that that's basically an invitation for more sexual predators, being that, well, if someone consumes alcohol or drugs voluntarily, it might not be sexual assault. Now, there were some reasons why the state Supreme Court ruled the way they did, and we'll get into that with Kevin Featherly coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Let's go through today's COVID-19 Minnesota update here in the state, and unfortunately, not such great news. The Monday COVID-19 report from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 1,550 new cases and 5 new deaths. The state has reported that 1.6 million people have received at least one dose of their COVID-19 vaccine, while just over 990,000 people have completed both doses of the vaccine that are required for, of course, the vaccine's maximum effect. So, certainly good news on the number of people who have been vaccinated, but the bad news when it comes to our COVID-19 update is that among the 1,550 new cases we had today, they came from 22,622. Now, not to get too deep into the math corner right now, but if you do the math on that, it means we have a test positivity rate of 6.85%. And that is above the CDC's guidelines of 5%, where they say if you have a test rate above 5%, that generally means the virus is spreading out of control. And unfortunately, with the latest numbers, we are above that number of 5%. In fact, our test positivity rate now over the past 7 days is above 5%. 5.56%. So we're not done with this thing, even though the vaccines are rolling out. I would encourage you now, get your vaccine if you can. Of course, eligibility does expand tomorrow, and you do need to be a little persistent if you are looking for one of those vaccines, especially for over the next few weeks, as demand is likely to outweigh supply. Look around at those different websites, whether it's Walgreens or a CVS or Thrifty. White usually has a ton of vaccine appointments available in greater Minnesota if you're willing to drive out of the cities about an hour or two. So go to that website, go to the Minnesota Department of Health website, and then click on COVID-19, and that will take you to some resources for where you can get your COVID-19 vaccination appointment, because we need to get this thing under control sooner rather than later, or we very well could be running into another spike of COVID-19. I think that would be, what, like our fourth wave that we have had in this country going back to last year. Hopefully the last wave if it does happen, but there is still time to prevent it. Make sure you go out, get your vaccine, and of course still mask and socially distance. We're not through this thing yet. We only got a few more months left. And Patrick, to me, that's the thing that bugs me the most about this, when I hear people saying, oh, we have the vaccines, take off your masks, or we have Florida and Texas rolling back their mask mandates. We have just a few more months left of this thing if we do it right. Do we really not have that much patience here in this country? I just don't get it. We could be done with this thing by the summer if we all just did our jobs.
Well, I think it just goes back to, you know, we never had any patience to begin with, even in the, you know, it may be in some of, you know, maybe in some of those states you were describing, they kind of, you know, kind of like, all right, fine, we should have some kind of measures. But you always had states like South Dakota were like, no measures, not now, not ever. And that was kind of, that set the tone for this whole mess I think we're in now.
Absolutely. And I would take an even more cynical approach with states like Texas and Florida. They clearly did it just to get spring break money. Of course, we're in late March right now, which means lots of people want to go on spring break. And being that, well, many people didn't get a spring break last year, a lot of people want to take those trips. And I think that's a big reason why Texas and Florida rolled back those mask mandates, because, well, we got to get those tourism dollars into our states. One other piece of COVID-19 news to report to you. This is actually some good news coming out of the city of Duluth, where a federal study with support from Duluth, Minnesota researchers has tracked the first two COVID-19 vaccines approved in the U.S. and found that they were 90% effective in real-world conditions and prevented, this is the important part, they prevented asymptomatic infections, which is just great news, because we knew the vaccines were capable of preventing the disease and preventing severe and even moderate symptoms, but if they can prevent asymptomatic infections, that's something we didn't know prior to now. That'll go a long, long way towards making sure we can get back towards some source of normalcy. Star Tribune writing about that. You can check that out over at StarTribune.com.
We're going to take a break and come on back, and I want to talk about H.R. 1 at the federal level as we're going to switch topics a little bit. H.R. 1 is a Voting Rights Act that was passed in the U.S. House by the Democrats. It's moved on to the Senate, and really, I think that is what the entire future of the Democratic Party hinges on, is getting H.R. 1 passed. We'll talk more about that coming up next here on The Matt McNeil Show, with Brett Johnson filling in for Matt on a Monday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Monday afternoon as Matt is away on assignment. Always like saying that phrase. He's away on assignment. Often hear that like in newscasts and such. I have no idea what that really means, but we'll roll with that. Matt is off on assignment today as I've stepped back into the hosting chair for at least one day, but have no fear. Matt McNeil is back in with a live show tomorrow. So during this final segment of hour number one of the show, I want to talk a little bit about H.R. 1. This is a bill that was passed in the U.S. House of Representatives that is basically a Voting Rights Act. It significantly expands voting access for many voters around the country and does a lot of good that we'll get into in just a second. And to me, I think this is possibly the most important bill that could be passed during the upcoming or during the current session that we're seeing right now in Congress. In fact, I would make the argument that if Democrats want any sort of power in Washington over the next decade, they have to get this thing passed. And there's a couple of reasons why. So if we remember back to the 2020 election cycle, of course, Joe Biden was able to become president of the United States because he won some narrow victories in states like Georgia and Arizona. Now, of course, what we've seen from Republicans in response to the Biden victory in states like Georgia and Arizona are a slew of new voter restrictions. Last week, of course, Georgia implemented their own new voter restrictions, including a provision that would make it a crime to give voters a food or drink within 150 feet of polling places. Florida has now joined the bandwagon, and they are putting in their own new voter restriction bills, and these are happening all over the country. In fact, this is the most amount of voting restriction bills we've seen throughout the entire country and state legislatures ever, and it's by a long shot. We've, I think, had well over 150 total bills proposed around different state legislatures around the country, and this is the most we've ever had in one cycle. Typically, we might see like 60 or 70 at most, but now we're well over 150. And a lot of these voting bills would, of course, as I was talking about, restrict voting by mail. They would require voting or voter ID for sending in a mail-in ballot. They would also have shorter amounts of polling access times that where polls would be open. So instead of having a poll open from, let's say, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., now they might say polls are only going to be open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Those are just some examples. Now, the one way Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives could counter some of these bills that are being proposed by state legislatures is H.R. 1. This is already, as I said, passed the U.S. House of Representatives and is now on its way to the Senate. And I hope it gets more attention than what it's gotten right now, because if the Dems want any sort of chance at holding power beyond 2022, they got to make sure this thing gets passed. So I want to talk about what really is in H.R. 1, because I'm guessing within the next few months, we're going to have an unprecedented negative campaign against H.R. 1. But here are just a few highlights of what this thing actually does. H.R. 1 creates a set of national voter registration and mail-in voting ballot standards. H.R. 1 requires the chief election official in each state, the Secretary of State in most, to establish an automatic voter registration system that gathers individuals' information from government databases and registers them unless they intentionally opt out. I see no problem with that whatsoever. The next one, and I think this might be the most important thing that H.R. 1 does, is that it establishes nonpartisan redistricting commissions in each state. This would combat gerrymandering that we've seen all over the country, primarily in Republican states. Now, to back up, what happens every 10 years, like in 2000, 2010, and now 2020, after those elections, we, of course, have a census. And we use that census information to draw new congressional and legislative districts, since, obviously, people will move from one area to another, so we have to redraw those boundaries. Now, Republicans had a lot of success after the 2010 midterm elections, where they basically won trifectas in a number of states, where they controlled both chambers of the state legislature and also controlled the governor's mansion. What that meant is that Republicans could largely draw their own congressional maps. And lo and behold, they did that in states like Wisconsin, where if we look back at the 2018 election cycle, Wisconsin Republicans in legislative races received about 48% of the vote. But they still ended up capturing and winning just over two-thirds of the legislative districts. So even though they received less than half the vote, they still ended up winning over two-thirds of the actual legislative races, thanks to gerrymandering. So this bill, H.R. 1, that the Dems have passed in the House and has now moved on to the Senate, would largely abolish gerrymandering. In an attempt to get rid of gerrymandering, the law would require each state to use independent commissions, not made up of lawmakers, which is key, to approve newly drawn congressional districts. The commissions would each include five Democrats, five Republicans, and five independents, requiring bipartisan approval for the districts to be allowed. Who could possibly argue against that? Can no one see what the problem would be of having legislators draw their own districts? That's essentially what you're saying, is you're allowing politicians to choose their voters rather than voters to choose their politicians. And that's the part right there that I think absolutely needs to get put into law, as we've seen a ton of gerrymandering all over the country over the past decade. And it's going to happen again in 2020, or excuse me, after 2020, once we get those census numbers in, since states like Texas and North Carolina, which are controlled by Republicans, are going to be gaining congressional seats. And if we've seen anything from some of these voting restriction bills that have been passed around the country, it's going to be gerrymandering on steroids if we don't get anything done. What else does H.R. 1 do? Big changes in campaign finance law. H.R. 1 would require super PACs and dark money groups to disclose their donors publicly, a step Democrats say would eliminate one of the most opaque parts of the U.S. election process. It would establish a public funding match for small donor donations financed by a fee on corporations and banks paying civil or criminal penalties. What else would H.R. 1 do? It would create a new ethics rule for public servants. It would create the first ethics code for Supreme Court justices. By the way, how do we not have one of those already for Supreme Court justices? And it would also stop a controversial practice in Congress where, when a member of Congress settles a sexual harassment or discrimination lawsuit, in certain cases, they can use taxpayer money to settle those lawsuits. H.R. 1 would ban that. And one of the final things H.R. 1 would do is put in a requirement that presidential candidates disclose their tax returns. Gee, I wonder who that could possibly be in response to. But to me, the two biggest parts of this bill are creating that nonpartisan redistricting commission in each state, and then having a set of national voter registration and mail-in voting standards. Now, already, these provisions are very popular among the American public. In fact, the Koch brothers have actually recognized this. This is coming out of a report from The New Yorker, who obtained a private conference call from January 8th between a policy advisor to Senator Mitch McConnell and leaders of several prominent conservative groups, including one run by the Koch brothers networks. And it reveals that the participants are very worried about the proposed election reform standards that are being proposed by Democrats. That would be H.R. 1. As the speakers on the call expressed alarm at the broad popularity of the bill's provisions, calling for more public disclosure about secret political donations. In fact, one of the senior advisors among these conservatives groups even told everyone, basically, there's no way we can campaign against H.R. 1. What we need to do is just tell all of the elected officials, just vote against this thing, ignore the will of the American voters, and try killing the bill in Congress instead. That's how concerned groups like the Koch brothers are about H.R. 1. It does, I think, a lot of good to reforming our election system, but It's got to be passed through the Senate, though. And that, of course, is where the problem lies, because to get that bill passed through the Senate, Democrats would either need 10 Republicans to come on board to break the filibuster, fat chance of that happening, or the Dems would need to eliminate the filibuster altogether. And that's what they need to do. Even if there are certain senators like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin who don't like making changes to the filibuster, well, to me, this pretty much is their entire career being in the Democratic majority hinges on passing H.R. 1. If this doesn't pass, Dems really have no one to blame but themselves if they end up in the minority after 2022 due to all of these voting restrictions that have been put in place around the country. Then, of course, more Republican gerrymandering that we're likely going to see coming up during the redistricting process if we don't get this bill put in place. So to me, beyond that COVID relief bill, which was just passed, H.R. 1 is the next most important thing. And even if there are moderate Democrats who don't want to abolish the filibuster, their entire political career, I think, pretty much hinges on the filibuster or hinges on eliminating the filibuster, or they can look forward to the next decade being in the minority. All right, we'll take a break and come on back with hour two of the show up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is not Matt McNeil joining you on this Monday afternoon. Nope, it's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt just for today, as Matt is away, but he will be back tomorrow for a live show. Patrick, we're going to go through about a 40-degree temperature drop within the next few hours. Right now, I just looked, and the temperature said it is officially 74 degrees, and I saw the high tomorrow is only going to be 34. I can't remember too many days like that where we've had a high temperature vary by 40 degrees within one day. So I don't know if you've ever experienced anything like that, at least in the Twin Cities, but I certainly haven't, so this will be quite the shock tomorrow when the temp goes down to 34.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think, though, it won't last. It's supposed to be back in the 70s by this weekend, which is nice.
Yeah, so nonetheless, I will not be biking tomorrow or Wednesday. I'll probably be back out there on Thursday, though. My limit is generally if the temp is below 40, I'm not going to bike. If it's above 40, you might get me out there for a little bit of time, maybe a short bike ride. But nope, tomorrow and Wednesday, definitely not going to be doing that. Here's what's coming up in hour two of Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil. Just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer, as we're going to be talking about this state Supreme Court case from last week that has to do with intoxication and sexual assault. Again, basically what the state Supreme Court ruled last week was that a person who is sexually assaulted while intoxicated does not fit the designation of the more serious rape charge if he or she consumed the alcohol or drugs voluntarily. Yeah, you're hearing that right. Essentially, if you consumed alcohol or drugs voluntarily and were assaulted, well, the assailant can't be convicted of rape. And that is due to a Minnesota Supreme Court ruling where they basically said that's not the way the statute is written. But as Justice Paul Thiessen talked about in his ruling, he said that this could very easily be rectified by the state legislature. And thankfully, there is a bill working its way through some different House committees that hopefully will get signed into law. We'll be chatting more about that case with Kevin Featherly coming up in a few minutes. Also, later on in the show, we'll be joined by Frank Brown of Minuteman Press Uptown. Frank was instrumental, as well as the other folks at Minuteman Press Uptown, in getting you those official AM 950 calendars. We printed those late last year, and many of you have already ordered those 2021 calendars. And in fact, there's still time. If you'd still like to get an AM 950 calendar, just go to am950radio.com under our members page. But we'll be chatting with Frank about Minuteman Press Uptown, talking about how they were able to help us print those calendars. And we'll also touch on how Minuteman Press Uptown has been able to survive the pandemic. They are a minority-owned union print shop, I think the only one in the state of Minnesota. We'll chat about that, and then also some thoughts on racial justice, since Frank is involved in the community with a number of organizations. That'll be coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Want to finish up some thoughts, though, on what I was talking about at the end of last hour with gerrymandering. And I just want to demonstrate the point about how damaging gerrymandering can be. Right now, among Minnesota's U.S. congressional delegation, we have 4 Democrats and 4 Republicans, which seems to match the partisan lean of the state, being that Minnesota is generally one of the more purple states in the country, although I would argue we are a little bit more of a bluish purple. But anyways, if you were to look at the partisan breakdown, yeah, having 4 Democratic congressional representatives and 4 Republican congressional representatives probably does fit in with Minnesota's partisan breakdown. But if we were to have gerrymandering in Minnesota, that could change significantly. And in fact, I even did a little bit of that with some mock gerrymandering. So there's this website from Dave Wasserman from NBC News. He's a big guy on gerrymandering, and he created his own website where you can do your own redistricting and gerrymandering. It's called Dave's Redistricting App. You can Google that and find it if you want, if you're a big political nerd like me who likes to play around with this thing. But the point is that I took my turn at pretending that I was a Republican who wanted to gerrymander Minnesota's 8 congressional districts. And I was largely able to gerrymander the state to the point where we would have 6 guaranteed Republican congressional districts and only 2 Democratic congressional districts. We could very easily be gerrymandered in Minnesota as well. So just think about that and why, as I talked about back in hour 1, HR 1 is so important. It only takes 1 bad election cycle where you can have 1 political party in charge of all of the levers in government, and then they get to go ahead and redraw their own districts. We saw that all over the country during the 2010s decade. And in Minnesota, we came close to having a Republican trifecta. It was only stopped by the fact that Mark Dayton won the gubernatorial election back in 2010 by only a few thousand votes. But if Tom Emmer had won that race, Minnesota would look like Wisconsin, where, like I said, in Wisconsin, Republicans received less than half of the votes in their state legislative races, but they still control 2/3 of the legislative seats. So just wanted to finish up my point with that. One other piece of news I want to bring up to you today, this has to do with COVID-19 vaccine passports. We've heard some chatter about this over the past few months. In fact, probably even going back to the beginning of the pandemic, where people were thinking that once we get a vaccine, could we run into a situation where we have vaccination passports that allow you to enter venues or shopping malls or other public places? Well, if we do have COVID-19 vaccination passports, they're not going to be coming from the federal government. This is coming out of Bloomberg. White House officials said that the push for vaccine passports should come from the private sector and that the federal government will not take the lead in creating a centralized document proving vaccination. Quote, vaccine passports that provide proof of immunity to the coronavirus are supported by the travel industry and other businesses that have suffered from concerns about the risk of the contagion in public places. Airlines are already backing a number of tech solutions they hope would give tourists and travelers more confidence. So I at least think from a political strategy standpoint, it is probably smart from the Biden administration not to have a federal database of COVID-19 vaccines. I could see that definitely going poorly and being used as a campaign issue against the Dems in 2022 and beyond. But having this come from the private sector is an entirely different animal, where you can't have Republicans and anti-vaxxers blaming the big bad government. If you lead that up to the private sector, which it sounds like is going to be the case with the airline and travel industry, that's private businesses, and private businesses can conduct their businesses that way, where if they want to have proof of vaccination before you can board a flight or go into a concert venue or go into a shopping mall, if that's a privately owned business, they have the power to do that. So we'll probably have more talk about COVID-19 vaccination passports, I would guess, sometime this summer. And in fact, I would wonder if we potentially could have a vaccination passport be a requirement to get into an event like, let's say, oh, I don't know, the Minnesota State Fair. You would think with how fast these vaccine rollouts have been over the past few weeks and months that we very easily could come close to reaching herd immunity before the state fair, which means, yeah, maybe if we have some vaccination passports, we could have a normal state fair without any capacity restrictions, but still a long ways to go before we reach that point. All right, we're going to take a break and come on back with Kevin Featherly of Minnesota Lawyer up next here on AM 950. Again, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Monday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back in, filling in for Matt McNeil here on this Monday afternoon. We're joined by Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer, as we're going to be talking about last week's sexual assault case that came before the state Supreme Court that will have, well, could potentially have a major impact on other sexual assault cases in Minnesota. Basically, what the court ruled last week is that a person who is sexually assaulted while intoxicated does not fit the designation for a more serious charge if he or she consumed the alcohol or drugs voluntarily. Again, that was according to the Minnesota Supreme Court ruling, as we'll be talking about that coming up in the interview with Kevin. But first, do want to welcome Kevin back to the show. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and actually, before we get into the Supreme Court case, I do briefly want to talk about the Chauvin trial. Nothing really specifically, since we are recording this ahead of time, but I know you're someone who often follows court cases around Minnesota as part of your job. And from the sounds of it, this is pretty unusual to actually have a trial like this live streamed at the district court level, correct?
Yeah, it's very unusual. I don't know that it's unprecedented. It may be unprecedented in the sense that it's live streaming over the internet. I don't know if there's never been a trial, you know, televised live in Minnesota, but it is extremely rare, particularly at the district court level where they're very strict about access.
Yeah, and you were saying it's not unusual at the appellate court level or the state Supreme Court level to have those trials streamed, but at the district level, they are very, very strict about it. Even having a recording device in there could potentially get you in some hot water, it sounds like.
Oh, yes. You've got to go through some pretty sensitive negotiations to bring a camera in the courtroom or a recording device. But there are reasons for that. The reason that the appellate court is less strict about that is because they don't have juries present. They don't have witnesses present. You know, nobody's going to be identified to, let's use the extreme case, to a gang member and, you know, put at risk at the appellate court level, because you really only have attorneys and the justices or the judges on the panel present. That's a different situation than the district court.
Yeah, so at least having this Chauvin trial, yeah, it does offer Minnesotans an opportunity to see this trial happening as it does, since in normal times, I imagine, we might not have access to this. So if you have the chance, you definitely... go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
Sorry. The camera angles are very tightly controlled. The jurors are not going to be placed on the screen. I imagine when we get to witnesses, however, when they're testifying, they will be speaking to us all.
Yeah. In fact, as I've already seen some of it, yeah, they do have direct video of those witnesses, so they are on there. But as you said, yeah, very unlikely they would show any of the jurors on camera, since that would definitely cause some major issues. All right, Kevin, so I want to move on to this case that happened last week at the state Supreme Court that has to do with sexual assault, where, again, the Supreme Court basically ruled in Minnesota is that if someone is assaulted while intoxicated, if the alcohol was consumed voluntarily, it doesn't necessarily fit the definition of rape. Now, I want to go to the background of this case, where it stems from. This has to do with a guy by the name of Francois, I apologize if I'm getting the name wrong, Mamalou Khalil, who was a Minneapolis man who was convicted of third-degree sexual assault because the victim was drunk and considered by the jury to be mentally incapacitated. So this would look like the type of case where, oh yeah, she was intoxicated, therefore this should be a rape case, but that's not exactly what the Supreme Court ruled. So, Kevin, let's talk about what the court ruled in this case with Khalil, because as the justices were reading through the statute, they said the plain text of the statute does not necessarily mean that the definition of being willfully intoxicated means that that can be sexual assault. Do I kind of have that right?
Yeah, in fact, what they found is that there's clear meaning in the statute as written that says that in order for mental incapacitation to take place, that person has to be administered, the substance, the anesthetic, the narcotic, alcohol, whatever it might be, has to be administered to that person without the person's agreement. And then that would then constitute lacking the judgment to give reasoned consent for sexual conduct. So what they found is that the legislature intended for that to be the case. And that appears to be true because I've done the research a little bit on it and looked at the original statute from, I forget when the year it was, I think it was 1975. And that phrase is there at the beginning from that very first statute. And I talked to Kelly Mahler today, the representative who has a bill we'll probably talk about a little bit later. She said that actually that language goes all the way back to the 1880s. And if you think about it, this is what she and I talked about, that language is sort of, I'm about to use a colloquial phrase that I hope you'll forgive me for, but it sort of speaks of the idea of shaming, doesn't it? Because what we're saying here is that If you, it's okay if you've been administered the substance and you weren't in agreement with it. But if you took this on your own, well, hey, that's kind of what the statute says.
Yeah,
and that's what the court ruled. They said we were hamstrung here. We can't find that this statute says something other than what it says.
Yeah, it's essentially blaming the victim, and as you said, that's what the justices were going by, is just a letter of the definition in the statute, because I do believe they said, well, technically Khalil could be charged with fifth-degree criminal assault, which would have a much, much lesser punishment as compared to the possible rape conviction that Khalil was going to be facing, and basically the judges were saying, we're hamstrung by the definition of this statute, we're not necessarily saying that this guy is innocent by any means, but the way that the statute is written, we're hamstrung, and that's up to the state legislature to make those changes.
They also found that the judge's instructions were in error, and they found that because there was a way for him to be convicted on the charge that they were going for, because there are two different areas. There's both mental incapacitation, and there's the component of physical helplessness. And in this case, that's why this is going back for retrial, by the way. This wasn't just simply overturned. This is going back for retrial. That guilty verdict could have been rendered basically on physical helplessness. But the problem was that the way the judge gave the instruction was problematic because the jury could read it two different ways. It could be read to say, because, and we talked about this a little while ago about the missing comma, it could be read to say that this is only true if a foreign, some other substance other than alcohol or an anesthetic is administered, or, and this is what the jury asked, what does this mean? Does this mean that other substance is the problem, that's the only one, that if it's administered by someone else, the penalty applies, or is it this whole thing? And the judge wound up saying, well, no, your first interpretation is the right one. Well, the court found, no, it's not, because you can't say, you again, by doing it this way, you're kind of writing out of law what is in the statute. I doubt I'm putting this across very clearly, but this is legalese for you.
Yeah, if you have an error like that, obviously it seems like it can cause some problem, or not necessarily an error, but the way that the judge's instructions were given were not correct. And yeah, that can certainly cause some problems in a courtroom, as I imagine.
Yeah, and I'll explain to you how that works. So here's what the judge said. A person is mentally incapacitated if she lacks the judgment to give reasoned consent to sexual penetration due to the influence of alcohol, a narcotic, or other substances administered without her agreement. Well, oops, there's supposed to be a comma after the word substance in that phrase. And without it, then it, the other substances, between the other substances and administered. And without that, it sounds like you're only isolating to that last phrase and the others, she could have taken this substance. She could have drunk the alcohol. She could have done any of these other things on her own, but this other substance, it would have to be administered by the other person. And what that what the judge then was essentially telling the jury is that, no, the law says that if she drank the alcohol on her own, she's still mentally incapacitated, and that qualifies for conviction on this charge. And then they did convict. But the court says, and by the way, the Court of Appeals upheld that. But the Supreme Court says, no, because that's not how the statute is written.
So I know a lot of people are concerned about this ruling and some of the possible impacts it could have on other sexual assault cases in Minnesota. Could this ruling have some major impacts in terms of how other cases have been decided with sexual assault and rape?
Potentially, although I think what will more likely result from this, and that's separate from any legislative change, which I think is, you know, a good possibility. I think that there would be some more clarity in the judge's instructions going forward. I think likely that would happen, because the thing that the court found is that there could have been a conviction on the physical helplessness. The only problem is that when you get to the appellate level, that panel is no longer a fact-finding panel. So justices can't poll the jury. They can't ask the jury, what were you thinking? You're beyond that when you get to the appellate level. All they can go by is the record. And there is a record of what the jury asked the judge. There's a record of what the judge responded, but there's absolutely no record whatsoever of the deliberations. And because of that, and because it's not clear whether the jury decided based on this erroneous instruction, or if they decided, as it could have been, rightly on physical helplessness, they just don't know. And so this has to go back for trial. So I can understand why people are concerned about it. I wouldn't share as deep a concern, because I think, you know, there's a pretty clear way around this in terms of jury instructions and certainly in the way that you charge these crimes. But we could also talk a little bit about the legislative response to this.
Yeah, I do want to get to that in just 1 second, but do just want to quickly clarify. So what's going to happen next in this case of Khalil, so he is going to be getting a new trial by the sounds of it, correct?
Yeah, this is being remanded to the district court.
So it'll, yeah, essentially be starting from square one. So he's not necessarily found not guilty or anything. He just gets a new trial is what's happening.
Right, right. And gotcha. And that is, you know, too bad. Well, that's sort of a almost dismissive way of putting it. It's very sad that this victim has to go through this again.
Gotcha. I'll edit out that little part there. Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Kevin, let's talk about what's happening now at the state legislature, because Representative Kelly Moeller, she is a DFLer, is trying to put a clear definition in the Minnesota laws that does make it a felony to have sex with someone who is too intoxicated to give consent, regardless of how they got this way, or how they got that way, rather. And you had a chance to speak with Kelly Moeller, I believe, a little bit about this bill, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, before I even get to that, I want to go back to the ruling just for a second, because one of the most remarkable things about it is it actually quotes Representative Moeller's bill. It actually references it by name, HF 707, and says, you know, essentially suggests this is the way out of this mess. You know, it's almost this is not what he's doing, but it's almost as though Justice Thiessen, who is a former Speaker of the House, by the way, is standing with a bullhorn on the Capitol lawn saying, pass this bill. You know? Mm-hmm. It's almost like that. And her legislation is actually, there are many, many components to it. It's like a 14-part bill, and it has a lot of different moving parts to it. But one of the things it would do is remove this idea that for somebody to be mentally incapacitated as a result of an intoxicant, it has to be somehow secretly administered to that person. So if somebody gets drunk, if somebody does, as the victim in this case apparently did, according to the trial record, drank and ingested a narcotic pill of some kind, that's not going to get you off the hook. It doesn't matter who or where it came from. Mental incapacitation as a result of intoxication is mental incapacitation and can be the element of a felony crime.
So where does that bill currently stand in the state House of Representatives? I believe it just passed the House Public Safety Committee unanimously, and now it looks like it's going to moving on to some other committees.
Yeah, it goes to Ways and Means. So that's its, you know, ostensibly could be its last stop, although sometimes Ways and Means will take a look and say, there's a problem here. We need you to send this back to committee and just fix this. But it is going to Ways and Means. Not so much movement in the Senate at this point. Senator Senjum has this bill, and it's been referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee. But as is sort of a common theme, it's one of the many bills that hasn't had a hearing, and it's not scheduled for one. That doesn't mean it won't have a hearing and that it's not going to end up being heard. But right now, there's nothing on the calendar. Of course, the legislature's off for this week, so there are no legislative committee hearings this week at all. But what's also likely is that this bill is going to get rolled up into some sort of, an omnibus package. So it might wind up being hammered out in conference committee, even if it's never heard in Senate, although frequently those bills don't survive. But it might have a chance, even if it's not heard in Senate, that because it'd be rolled up into a larger omnibus, they still may have to reckon with it.
And I imagine there has to be some urgency behind this bill now, too, given the recent court ruling, well, and the fact, too, that this thing got out of the Public Safety Committee on a unanimous vote. So it seems like there is broad agreement between Republicans and Democrats that something has to be changed with this statute.
True enough, but we have seen instances, for instance, with the DWI bill, a package of bills, that had broad agreement in the House, bipartisan agreement, but Senator Limmer, for reasons that are confounding to Senator Ron Lapps, who watched that bill pass, haven't heard it, and it's sort of dismissive of the idea that it had bipartisan support in the House because, after all, it's the House. It's irrelevant to us. That's sort of how he treated that. But Senator Limmer pays attention to what the courts have to say, and I wouldn't be surprised if he finds a way to get this bill heard, because there is obviously impetus from the court. They've told the legislature exactly what they can do to avoid this really sort of tragic consequence. You know, the fact that this woman has to go back and deal with this all over again.
Yeah, that is the saddest part of this thing, is that this woman who was the victim of sexual assault has to go back through that entire trial again. So hopefully we do end up getting some action from both the House and especially the Senate side so we can get something put into law. So yeah, hopefully we never run into this situation again. Because as you said, just looking at the human element, that's very traumatic to make someone go through that trial twice. So yeah, hopefully something can end up getting passed in the state legislature. Hey, that's
one
Kevin.
Thing that might be, might speak to her. One thing that might speak, you know, to that. If a bill passes and it passes because of her experience, I've seen where some folks have found that to be sort of justice enough. It may not be what they were seeking, but the fact that legislation passed as a result of their experience and that other people won't have to go through it is something that some people find it, you know.
Well, hopefully we'll have some action on that bill in the next few weeks over at the state legislature. That is Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer. Great resource to follow along with what's happening at the state legislature. Again, make sure you give Kevin a follow on Twitter over at Kevin Featherly, or go to Minnesota Lawyer as well. Hey, Kevin, really appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Frank Brown of Minuteman Press Uptown. Minuteman Press Uptown was the company that helped us print our AM 950 official calendars. And we'll be chatting with Frank about his business coming up next here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Monday afternoon as we're joined now by Frank Brown. He is the owner of Minuteman Press Uptown. And if you've gotten an AM 950 calendar, well, you might be a little familiar with Minuteman Press Uptown, because they're the ones that printed our awesome calendars for 2021. They were instrumental in making sure we got these things out, and it's been a huge, huge success. And obviously, the calendars look amazing as well. So figured we'd chat with Frank about that, what else Minuteman Press Uptown has been doing, as well as some activism that Frank is involved with in Minneapolis. So, hey, Frank, how you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful, wonderful. And about those calendars, I think you guys provided some wonderful graphics for us to put in the calendar, which was very helpful. So you guys did your part.
Yeah, yeah. And Matt McNeil deserves a lot of credit on that. He took all those photos over the past year. And yeah, it overall just looks awesome in there. And by the way, you can still order your calendars over at am950radio.com if you haven't yet. Still not too late, even though we're in late March, still 9 months left in the year. So encourage you to do those. So I want to ask you, first off, Frank, how have you guys over at Minuteman Press Uptown been surviving COVID-19 and, of course, some of the civil unrest we saw last year? Obviously, these are very trying times for just about every business right now, but how have you guys been managing through the pandemic thus far?
Well, I'll say we're very fortunate to be an essential business, so we were allowed to remain open during, you know, all these events during COVID, as well as during the unrest here in Minneapolis. The first month, last March, March of last year, it was a struggle. And I had to lay off employees, and we were down to like three employees, myself, a graphic designer, and a customer service person. And me and the customer service person basically did all the production that we could do to, you know, to get things out. But we were slow enough that we could go down to three employees. And after March of last year, then things started picking up, and things started coming around. By May, we were, you know, fairly back to normal, you know, of the year before. Now, I will add this, that it was an election year, and because it was an election year, it was supposed to be really a banner year for us. It actually was the best year I've ever had, but it should have been even more better. And I don't know if that's correct to say it that way, but it was supposed to be much better than what it was. And actually, what really helped, believe it or not, you know, I don't say that this was a good thing, but the civil unrest and what happened to George Floyd, you know, which was wrong, really raised awareness in our community about Black lives and Black-owned businesses. And after that happened, I ended up getting a lot of support from the community and from elsewhere, that people were actually looking at supporting Black-owned businesses because, you know, they knew that, you know, what happened was part of structural racism, and they wanted to help reverse that by supporting a Black-owned business like myself. Now, there was some unrest up the street, and they burned down a Super America, and they broke into the Walgreens on Hennepin. So, you know, people were really concerned that they would start coming up Hennepin towards downtown. And I noticed that my employees, they were kind of nervous, and they asked if they could go home, and I sent them home so they could go home when there was unrest up the street. And then I kind of walked up the street to see what was going on, and I noticed other businesses were putting up boards on their windows to protect their businesses. And frankly, I'll be honest with you, I wasn't really prepared for that. So I basically made some signs real quick and said, you know, that said Black-owned business and, you know, justice for George Floyd. So they know that I'm, you know, I'm part of the movement, you know, and, you know, hopefully they wouldn't harm my business. And frankly, my business survived. Nobody touched my business. You know, there's actually some neighbors, you know, in the area that were kind of watching businesses too as well, trying to keep things secure in the area. So things turned out pretty well, you know, during that scare for my business. And like I said, we've been doing a lot of stuff like Black Lives Matter signs, masks, things like that, things for the movement that have really, you know, supported the movement and allow other people to support my business, which has been very helpful. And like I said, we had the best year ever last year, which was surprising to me. And I think a lot of it was just, like I said, being a Black-owned business and, you know, knowing that. And, you know, and of course, I'm going to market towards whatever the trends are going on in the community to hopefully capture some of that, because I'm also a businessman too, you know, and I want to try to be as successful as I can.
Well, I'm glad that really happened as well, where people were paying attention and trying to support black-owned businesses, because I think for a long time, when people would hear Black Lives Matter, even those who supported the movement, it was, for lack of a better way of putting it, from 10,000 feet away, where it was just a slogan that you could say, yeah, I support black lives. But when people are able to go out and support black-owned businesses, I think that's an entirely different thing, and actually recognizing what Black Lives Matter means. That's at least what I was kind of picking up a little bit last year, too. Obviously, it would have been nice if that happened under more ideal circumstances and not the murder of George Floyd, obviously. But I think that has been something that's come out of there, where people have been more willing to support black-owned businesses and recognize the movement of Black Lives Matter.
That is so true. And, you know, I think some of the larger corporations and industries are realizing that, you know, there has been some sort of structural racism within, you know, their industry or within their own businesses. And we're starting to see more people hire. You have more diversity. You know, there was a big diversity movement back in the 90s, but it really didn't really catch on. But I think it's really starting to catch on here in Minnesota. I'm a member of the Printing Institute of the Midwest. It's an organization of all the printers here in the five-state area. And they started a diversity committee to basically promote diversity within our industry, because our industry in the printing industry, it's been a good old boys industry where not too many people of color have been involved, especially in management and ownership, you know, being the only black-owned union printer in the state and, you know, one of the very, very few black-owned printers, the largest black-owned printer in the state. I can see that when I go into rooms with other printers, you know, I look around and I'm the only African-American in the room, you know. And so I think it's important that industries realize that, you know, stock industries that have been around for a while and start looking at moving African-Americans, you know, into positions where they're managing and doing other things.
Well, another aspect of your business that you mentioned is that you're also a union shop, which I imagine is probably unusual in the print industry to have an actual union. And I think that's great for your employees. And I want to ask you about how that impacts your day-to-day business and how that's overall worked, being able to have a union shop in Minneapolis.
Well, being a one of the only union printers on the Minneapolis side of the river, has given me some advantages, you know, as well as being black-owned. I mean, I'm going to promote the things that are going to sell my business. And actually, it's actually a good thing to be, you know, a black-owned business right now. And so being that in combination with the union has allowed me to, I want to say exploit or target a niche market of organizations as well as politicians who need a union printer. And a lot of times, if they're really progressive, they not only want a union printer, they want to support a minority-owned business. And having both together has been a real plus for my business. I tell you, when I started my business back in 2008, I was out of my basement. And I was involved with DFL stuff, you know, political stuff, as well as organizations that, you know, are very progressive. And I used to see if they wanted me to, you know, print for them. And I couldn't get their business because they said they were looking for a union printer. And I wasn't a union printer because I was by myself in my basement. And so when I bought Minuteman Press back in 2015, that was exactly the first thing I did, was make it a union shop. And, you know, there's also the benefit of paying livable wages, giving people benefits and stuff like that. But also from a business standpoint, it's a good marketing tool if you really can be in touch with that particular market.
We're speaking with Frank Brown. He is the owner of Minuteman Press Uptown. Again, you can find them over at 2101 Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis. They did a great job helping us print our official AM 950 calendars. Frank, I want to move on to another topic, and that's the fact that you're very involved in the community as well, besides owning Minuteman Press Uptown. You're, of course, involved and are a board member of Take Action Minnesota, but you're also involved with this group called Yes Minneapolis. Can you tell us a little bit about Yes Minneapolis for anyone who doesn't live in the city. Obviously, I think some folks who live in Minneapolis might be familiar with the organization and what you guys are trying to do with law enforcement in the city. But tell us a little bit about Yes Minneapolis and what you do working with that movement.
Well, I'll say I work with the movement through Take Action Minnesota, because Take Action Minnesota is a supporter of this movement. And it all started because of what happened with George Floyd. You know, we want to change things, change the way policing is done in Minneapolis. You know, we want to defund the police or remove it from the charter and see if we can start all over with that whole public safety thing. You know, see if we can, you know, get more de-escalation training, more mental health workers involved in public safety, you know, and really look at how the police, the chief of police is selected. That's one of the other things that we're trying to do, because, you know, we think that, you know, we need more people involved with that, as well as having some outside citizens reviewing things that happen, you know, arrests and things that happen because of the police department and in the police department, to ensure that the public is really getting what they're paying for and not getting hurt by, you know, what they're putting tax dollars into.
And you and I had a chance to chat a little bit about Yes Minneapolis off air, and you were talking about how there is still a need, obviously, for law enforcement when it comes to whether we have a murder, serious violence, or sexual assault. Yeah, we do need law enforcement in those situations, but it's also important to point out that for other types of instances, maybe it's a better idea to have a social worker respond to a 911 call, or people who are actually trained to deal with someone that is going through a mental health crisis. And I think that's what we were kind of talking about with the Yes Minneapolis. That's really what the movement is pushing for. It's not abolishing law enforcement and having no laws whatsoever in Minneapolis. That's not at all what we're talking about. It's making sure we have a better system of law enforcement that doesn't target minorities.
That is so true. I mean, we've taken the brunt of it. I mean, Philando Castile, George Floyd. I mean, you look at the number of people that are African American, black and brown people that have been killed by the police. And, you know, I think our community is frustrated. And I'm not just going to say our community. I think the whole Minneapolis is behind some kind of change. You know, and there's different extremes on the change. You know, some people want little change, keep the police intact because, you know, they're neighbors and they're worried about, you know, they're worried about criminal activity in their neighborhoods, while other people, you know, look at it as police attacking citizens. And so they, it ends up being the police are the enemy, and maybe we need to, you know, do something about them attacking citizens. So it's a very complicated issue, I'll say. And I think in the end, it's going to take people coming together and actually talking about real solutions to this problem, because it's been going on for too long. It's been going on for decades, I'll say.
Absolutely. And really that started to get highlighted a lot more when, unfortunately, we had cell phones that could have recorded a lot of what we saw when, as you were mentioning, yeah, in previous decades, this still was happening, but we just weren't able to document it. So, as you said, yeah, this is nothing new, what we've been seeing over the past few years. A couple more final questions for you here, Frank. Where can people go to get involved with Take Action Minnesota and also Yes Minneapolis?
Well, there is a website for Yes Minneapolis. It's yes4minneapolis.org, and you can sign the petition. And with Take Action Minnesota, our website is takeactionminnesota.org, and you can become a member and actually get involved in some of the things that we're doing. You know, what's important about Take Action Minnesota is you're part of a larger organization, and being part of a larger organization, it gives you more power to really move things, because as an individual, we can only, you know, we can speak our mind, be heard, but when you have a whole organization behind you, then people really listen, and they take note, and they move.
Absolutely, yeah, and it helps, too, if whether you're doing that or even running for elected office certainly helps as well. And that's kind of where I'd go with the final topic here, Frank, because as we say in your ads, you print everything over at Minuteman Press Uptown, which is definitely true. And as we are going to be heading into a very competitive election season in Minneapolis, of course, with the mayoral race and others, you guys can certainly help any candidate print material that they need for the campaign, whether it's flyers or door hangers. I'm trying to think of what those things are that you would hang on. Is that what they're called? Door hangers?
Yes, there's door hangers.
Door hangers, flyers. Yeah. Basically flyers. Yeah, you guys do print everything. So if someone is thinking about maybe getting involved this fall, whether it's running for city council or even another office in Minneapolis, you guys can definitely help with all of their marketing needs.
Yes, we can. And during this, the COVID times, even though hopefully it's coming to an end, you know, there's a lot of less direct contact. So we do a lot of bulk mailing right now. You know, people want to, you know, send bulk mail out to their districts or their wards so they can contact voters. And I think that's important right now. We'll be coming up to caucusing, and after caucusing, there'll be primaries, you know, and then the election. And, you know, the best way to contact voters is through direct mail, yard signs. That's another great form of advertising when you can't do the direct contact, as well as, like you mentioned, the door hangers, where you just kind of leave a door hanger on their front door, and then they can just pick it up and see your information. You know, I've had some people who are running for office, they're blanketing neighborhoods, just putting their door hangers on every door because, you know, they're just trying to get the word out. And I think they're being effective because, you know, people are starting to know and they're starting to read and they're interested in what's going on in Minneapolis and what's going to go on when we get a new city council and a new mayor.
That's Frank Brown with Minuteman Press Uptown. Again, a Black-owned and also union print shop in Minneapolis. They do print everything and encourage you to use them for all of your printing needs. They did a great job on our calendars, and there's lots of ways you can get a hold of them. Website is mpuptown.com. That's mpuptown.com, and they're also located at 2101 Hennepin Avenue. Frank Brown, really appreciate the time today talking about your business and also some of the community events that you're involved with.
Well, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to, you know, talk a little bit about my business and what we're doing and letting people know that we're still here and we're here to serve the community.
Again, a big thanks to Frank Brown of Minuteman Press Uptown for helping us print our official AM 950 calendars. By the way, you can still order one if you want over at am950radio.com. I'm just about out of time for the show today. Matt McNeil is going to be back in studio tomorrow. Thanks for listening.